costly, and you are so lucky you are in the right place. I'm a board member for the Boston Book Festival, so you will find no more enthusiastic reader or lover of books. So I'm glad you are all here. I have two pieces of business. Please turn off your cell phones so that we will not be interrupted as we go on through this wonderful conversation. The second piece of business, because I am on the board, I want to make certain that you fill out the surveys in which you will say, we were all delightful. Not to instruct you or anything. And I must give praise to Maisie Houghton, who is sponsoring this event. And who doesn't love memoir, right? You're all here, we love memoir. I was thinking to myself as I read these three great books, what a talent it is to present your unique experience and then have it resonate with all of the rest of us who do not share anything of your life, but we are drawn into your life because it's so special in the way that you've done it. And I resonated on so many levels with each of these ladies and their books. And I have to say, what I thought was also interesting is that, just coincidence, I guess, each of their stories, very individual, obviously unique to them, could be ripped from the headlines. So here we have Eileen Rockefeller, and people are talking about the 1%, what it means, and then also her support of environmentalism and where that's gone, right from the headlines. Then next to her, as we have Najla Saeed, we're talking about people finding their identities and also what does it mean to be Arab American, particularly in the wake of 9/11. And then next to her, Monica Wood, whose story of a family growing up in a tiny town in Maine really speaks to not only the togetherness of a Catholic family at a certain period of time in our country, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy in the background, but also what happens when a town loses its center, its engine of employment, as the mill was going away in her town. All of these stories ripped from the headlines. Now I'm gonna do two things. I'm gonna ask each of the authors to read a tiny bit from each book so you get a sense of the flavor of what they're going on. And I wanna assure you, there will be a solid block of time for you to ask questions at the end, because I can't stand it if I'm in the audience and I can't ask questions. So I'm feeling you.
You sure are.
All right. Monica, why don't you start?
Okay, I'll start. The town is Mexico, Maine, which is a paper mill town in western Maine. And we lived in a triple-decker on the top floor. And on the bottom floor were the Norcases, our very colorful, is this okay?
I'm having
some Lithuanian landlords. And they didn't like kids, and they had a lot of rules. No go in garden, no car in driveway, no too much garbage, no too much stairs, which meant you couldn't bring a non-resident child up the stairs. So we were terrified of them, and I get all the humor and kind of colorfulness of them. But then at the end of this one chapter, I kind of give them their full humanity. And this is about how all the rules they had. We need our things. We protect our things. We make rules around them if we have to. The Norcases guarded their stairs because they loved their stairs. They had bought those stairs and the building attached to them by leaving their mamas and their cherry trees and their big blue sky and their language and their nation. They guarded their garden because they loved their garden. Every carrot and parsnip and rhubarb stem. They guarded their driveway because they loved their driveway. Every crack and fissure and shiny knot of frost-heaved tar. It took years for me to know this, to see how loss can tighten your grip on the things still possible to hold.
Monica Wood, When We Were the Kennedys.
Okay, hi. I should probably just explain a little bit about who I am. My father was Palestinian. He was an outspoken advocate for Palestinian rights, but he was also an English professor at Columbia. He was born in Palestine, baptized Anglican, Episcopalian. So I was born here in Boston as an Episcopalian. I went to private school, and I had no idea that I was from the Middle East because I didn't seem to fit in I thought I was Jewish. I grew up in the Upper West Side. I went to school with WASPs. Then I went to school with Jews, so I thought I was Jewish because I had dark hair, and I didn't, but I was still Episcopalian. It was very confusing. So, and then my mother is from Lebanon, and her family happens to be Quaker, so I'm not even going to go there. So I'm like the Palestinian WASP Jewish person. So, and yet my father is most famous. His name is Edward Said. He's most famous for being Palestinian, even though he was a professor of 19th century British literature. So wow. This is just a little bit about, this is one of my favorite stories, I just lost the page, about my brother and I. So my brother is 2.5 years older than I am. Once, when I was about 5 and Wadia 7, we were sitting in the back of our blue Buick as my father drove us through Central Park at Christmas time. I remember looking out at the lights that had been strung in the trees, feeling warm and safe in the car with my pretty coat and tights and my favorite shoes with bows on them. My father, as always, had turned the radio on to one of the classical music stations, WNCN or WQXR, which was broadcasting holiday music. I pressed my head against the window and stared up toward the stars, and I began to sing along to a Christmas carol I had learned in school. Noel, 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 born is the king of Israel. My pleasure was abruptly cut short by a swift smack on the arm. Ow! Wadia, why'd you hit me? Nash, you're supposed to say occupied Palestine. I had no idea what he was talking about. This was a song about Christmas, and we celebrated Christmas. So how come the other kids could say Israel, and I had to say occupied Palestine? I rubbed my wounded arm and appealed to my father for help. He dutifully chided my brother for hitting me and confirmed that I was allowed to sing the song as it was written. Mostly, I think my dad was amused by Wadia's attempt to impress him. My brother was only 7 years old, but he had obviously picked up on the fact that my father, when discussing the question of Palestine with friends and colleagues, always referred to what we now call the West Bank and Gaza as occupied Palestine. This was well before any roadmaps or peace plans or lessons on political correctness. Feelings were still raw, the occupation was still relatively new, and monikers had not yet been set. I have no doubt that the conversation in the car continued after this brief sibling spat. I have no doubt that my father carefully explained things to my brother and that my brother listened intently, asked thousands of questions, and then went home to read books on the subject. I have no doubt that I was supposed to be listening to this argument so that I would not make the same mistake and assume that references to ancient Israel in hymns, prayers, and scriptures were evidence of a Zionist prejudice. But I was gone. I was lost in the reverie of my Christmas daydream, imagining what baby Jesus looked like in his manger and wondering what were frankincense and myrrh.
That's wonderful.
Nezra Said looking for Palestine.
Eileen?
Wow, I'm struck by the similarities already. Mm. I'm seeing several themes of scarcity and abundance and diversity of religion and identity. And so I am a Rockefeller, and I'm still becoming myself. I don't think I'll ever stop becoming. And though I was born into a Protestant family, my mother hated church. My father wished she'd gone, but sort of gave up by the time I, the sixth one and last one, came along. And later, in marrying my husband, who's a Jew, I expanded to Judaism, and we raised our sons as Jews with the rituals that I've grown to really love. And so the scarcity and abundance theme comes into my life not so much in terms of lack of physical belongings, possessions, but in terms of emotional scarcity, of not feeling we had enough, and always being conscious of the ledger. In fact, if anyone had ever, and they did, some of my friends ever said, oh, you're Eileen Rockefeller, you're a Rockefeller. I wanted to hit them. Mm-hmm. I didn't want that word broadcast through the room. So it's a big deal for me to be saying it like this. This is the first chapter, the story I didn't want to tell. John D. Rockefeller was my great-grandfather. For years, my siblings and I tried to keep this a secret because his name created such a buzz. Adulation, judgment, envy, and endless curiosity flew around us like a swarm of bees. I was afraid of the sting. People saw us as different, and that set us apart. Their preconception of my family as akin to royalty contributed to my sense of isolation and loneliness. I live with anxiety and gratitude, just like the generations of Rockefellers before me. Without anxiety and the desire to heal it, I would not be writing this story. The physical comforts and circumstances of my life were undeniably different from most people's. I grew up in big houses with lots of servants. I was given an allowance that could probably be considered large, and I went to school in a chauffeur-driven limousine. We called it the hearse, or curse, because before the oldest ones left for boarding school, we needed a car large enough to carry all six of us. It had two jump seats in back. My siblings and I, and it turns out my cousins too, jumped out a block or two before we arrived at school so we could walk up to the door just like everyone else. We tried to hide who we were because we wanted to fit in, and also because my mother trained us not to stand out. As an heir to the Rockefeller legacy, I have found that real richness and power comes not from the amount of money, but from our connection to ourselves and one another. I think that's enough mm-hmm. for now, don't you?
It's very nice.
Eileen Rockefeller. So you've mentioned so many thematic connections. At the center of each of your family stories is a father figure which plays out differently in each of your lives as you articulate. And what I thought was also interesting is that each of you early on in life pretended or wanted to be someone other than who you are. Monica, when you write about your father's death, which is the pivotal point in your book, and then you tell the rest of your story, you for a long time wanted to pretend that you were a member of another family, mm-hmm. one with a father.
Yes.
Talk
yes.
about that and the whole unraveling of telling the story about identity, finding who you were.
Well, that's such a great question. I haven't been asked that before, and I love it, because there were two families, really. One lived almost next door, and it was the Valancourt family. My town was Maine is a funny place. All of the coastal towns, you get that Yankee seafaring, it's a different accent, everything. And the inland towns, what I call rural industrial Maine, all the mill towns along the Androscoggin River and the Penobscot River and the Kennebec River, they were founded very differently. Immigrants came in literally by the trainload from Italy, Lithuania, Ireland, French Canada, Irish-speaking Canada, to work in the paper mills and the textile mills and all of these mills. So our town was all white, but culturally diverse in that sense. People brought music and food and language from lots of other countries. So I had a lot of Franco friends. Vaillancourt is what the nuns would call Denise Valancourt. Mm-hmm. Denise Vaillancourt. And her father also worked in the mill and was a very kind, kind man. And after my father literally dropped dead on his way to the paper mill one morning, I kind of glommed myself on to that family, as I think a lot of kids do, whether they are missing a father or not. But the other family was the Kennedy family. This all happens in 1963 when I was nine. And I sort of caught from my mother the kind of, it's a weird thing to say, but almost a relief that the same thing, this sudden, unimaginable death had happened to the most glamorous family on the face of the earth. And I could see my mother, who was ashamed to be widowed. She was afraid people would think she couldn't take care of her kids. I could see how Jackie Kennedy's grace and dignity in her widowhood restored my mother's own dignity to her. Very interesting.
And Catholic, that connection
as
well.
Oh, needless yes. to say. We had a picture of John Kennedy in our living room and in my classroom at St. Teresa's School. Yeah.
Now, in your house, Najla, you were constantly saying to your parents, be American. What's this Arab stuff? Drop this stuff. Let's talk about some of that as you were here in the house with the guy who defined identity for so many people.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
It's yeah. a little weird. Okay, this is my confession, and most people have asked me about this. The reason I wrote this story is because I think people assumed that, as I said, a lot of what I learned about identity growing up, and I think we all learn, is that You're given categories, and if you don't fit in them, you don't know what to do with yourself, especially in this country. So a lot of this book, as Eileen had said, I also don't know really what, if I found myself yet. But I was born here in Boston. My dad was teaching at Harvard, and then my parents lived in New York. So we moved back to, I always say I was born and raised in New York, but when I'm in Boston, I'm like, I was born in Boston. So I grew up on the Upper West Side, which at the time, as now it's a very fancy sort of neighborhood, but at the time it was not considered that way. And it was very Jewish. It was like I was surrounded by all of Woody Allen's characters from his pre-1989 films. And then I went to school on the Upper East Side, the same school that actually Jackie Kennedy went to. So you can see what kind of school I went to. And so already I was on the wrong side of town, and I had the wrong hair color, and everyone seemed to be Irish in England. And I kept telling my dad, I want to be Irish. And he was like, you want to be Irish? You are Irish. You're Palestinian. What you want to be is a wasp. And I was like, what? But anyway, I had no idea what was going on. And I was, there were Christians and there were Jews. That's what I was taught. And there were blondes and there were dark-haired people. So I couldn't find myself to fit in. And then at the same time, my dad was literally writing this book, Orientalism, about how there are these one-dimensional stereotypes of especially Arab and Middle Eastern and Muslims in Western culture, and how they're made up and they're not real. And I was, as I say in the book, watching I Dream of Jeannie and wondering why she was so pretty and blonde and had magic powers and was from Baghdad. And I was like this hairy mustache kid with like no magic powers, and I wasn't very sexy. I mean, I was like six, so there was that, and there was this real desire to just fit in somewhere. And I seemed to, as I said, you know, religiously, I mean, I was baptized Episcopalian. My grandmother, my dad's mother, was from Nazareth, from Palestine, and she was a Baptist because her father had come to America and gone to Waco, Texas, and become a Baptist minister, and then moved back to Nazareth, Palestine, where Jesus is from. Anyway, so I was given these categories, and I wanted to fit into one of them. And then there's this idea that even though my father is sort of, in many ways, because he kept saying, you know, you're Palestinian, you're Arab, you should be proud of that, there was a part of him that was just a huge part of him, he was a humanist, and he believed that all people were people. So I was sort of getting two messages. One is you should define yourself, and the other message was everyone is the same, and there's no difference between people, and also, as I mentioned, my mom was Quaker and was raised that way as well. So I just, everything, I mean, it's so funny, because nowadays all these kids eat hummus, and I was like hiding my pita bread and hummus and, you know, all the, and that's the thing that sort of makes the story universal, which was not that I was necessarily, even though I was raised by this person who was very proud of his background and very, very strongly identified as a Palestinian, and my mom was very, very Lebanese, I still just wanted to fit in and be American. So in a lot of ways, my story was very much the immigrant child, the kid of any immigrant in this country, it's the same experience as any immigrant in this country. And so I think that was,
Or someone who was considered other, because I related on that level.
Of course.
Oh, you know, you're
or
other.
Just even a female or anything.
Exactly.
So
Eileen, you're already defined. Even before you're born, you're defined because you've got the Rockefeller name.
Yeah.
And I thought in terms of your journey of becoming yourself, your title is perfect because you had to work in the context of that and then try to find yourself. And certain expectations were assumed for you.
Yes, they were. And I dedicated the book both to my husband, Paul, and also to my grandmother, Abby Aldrich Rockefeller, for giving me the dream of belonging. And I think that's the piece I want to talk about right here, because it relates to what both of you have said, that you're right, America has asked its immigrants to assimilate. Mm-hmm. And even as far back as the 20s, which was when she, as my grandfather, John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s wife, would go to Bay State, to New Jersey, to where the the Standard Oil industry was. And she made it a point to visit, and I have a story about this in my book, to visit door to door the immigrants, to welcome them to America. And she visited everybody. She didn't know who was going to be behind the door, but she would walk up with her long pearls and her long white gloves and a little hat cropped on her head. And she had a rather feminine, rotund body and full skirts. And she'd knock on the door, and somebody would come looking quite scared from behind it. And she'd say, "Oh, hello. I'm Mrs. John D. Rockefeller, and I've come to welcome you to America." Just be amazed and probably terrified and feeling not good enough because they hadn't become American yet. But what she did, which I think is such a lesson of the values that I've inherited, is she'd go in and she would just be as natural as ever, and they'd offer her tea, and the children would be scurrying around and playing with a wooden spoon or a box or something. They didn't have much money, and they'd always offer her tea. And so as the conversation eased, she would always ask them, because this was the point of commonality, "Do you have an object from the old country that, you know, that you brought with you?" And invariably, they would scurry back to some room, and they'd open a drawer or a closet. They had obviously hidden the something of value because it represented their culture, and they were supposed to obliterate it. But she honored that as a collector of folk art, and the Abby Aldrich Rockefeller Folk Art Museum at Colonial Williamsburg is a great example of her passion for this, as seen as a connecting point to human beings and to the soul of human beings, because beauty is what connects all of us. Beauty connects to spirit, and beauty outlasts us. So they would bring her a little ceramic bowl or a weaving or whatnot, and she would admire it and speak about what she loved, and then she would leave them with the final thought of, "Make sure you always keep this in a place of honor. Don't forget your roots." And somehow she had that innate wisdom that even as we change and we move along to different cultures, different religions, different kinds of people, we must be rooted just like a tree. And art is one of the great tap roots of all time.
And so what you've done is be rooted as well and talk about your own roots in this book. And deciding to share who you were. And this is the first woman in your family to write a memoir.
Yes.
And if anybody is familiar with Doris Kearns Goodwin's work, and I'm sure you are, you know that she says, most is revealed through what women write, generally.
Yeah, that's
and we
true.
Really find out what the stories are. Mm-hmm. So let me ask this. A memoir is a really special thing to write because it's so revealing of yourself. What was the hardest part for you to write? Because either you were reliving it and it was a tough thing, or you wanted to make certain that people got what you meant. Any of you?
Well, since I didn't answer the personal question, if it's okay, I'll go first.
Yeah. Eileen, I just want to say that story about your grandmother. Oh, I'm going to remember that the rest of my life. Thank you for telling that.
Thank you, Monica. Yeah. Well, as you see, I'm still moved.
Yes.
And I never met her. The reason I honored her in the dedication is that I did have a dream about her coming to a house I'd been given by my parents, looking at the art that she had placed there, and saying in this dream, "These paintings, along with this house, are yours now, and if you need to move them, whatever way you want, you must do that." And I mean, so anyway, she's always been a spirit guide to me, but the piece about my own root, and what was hardest to write in this memoir was when I went beyond the initial stories were about a favorite time of an experiment in simple living that we did with our boys to bring them to our land in Vermont and live on the farm as if in the 1840s for 5 months, because we wanted our sons to understand the value of work, the value of family, the value of community, both nature and human, the value of handwork. There were so many lessons that could be garnered from this kind of thing. But by the time I'd finished it, I realized they're still too young. They had just gone off to college. They wouldn't want a book published about their younger years. That's when they would have been embarrassed. So I dug deeper, and I went to my family of origin, and that's when the real work began. Because it is, of course, for all of us, for each of us, in our family of origin is the first mirror that we have. Mm-hmm. And it's often inaccurate. And so the task we have in the rest of our lives is to look for other more accurate mirrors, both through the communities of support in our place of worship, in our neighborhoods, in our friendships, and then finally to look deeply in the mirror at ourselves to find out who we are. So it was the going back, having to remember in excruciating detail the feeling of being lonely and left out, given the fact that the next oldest for me was 3 years older, and then the next oldest was just 4 years older, so they were close, then two sisters 15 months apart, and my oldest brother 10 and a half years older. So the four middle ones were a clan, and they were an exclusive one. And those were really tough times. And I'm a very sensitive person naturally. I'm a more emotionally outgoing, sort of obviously emotional person. And that didn't fit the family culture in the 50s. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to express yourself so well. But going back to those relationships and exploring them with each of my siblings now in a mutual commitment to heal what was broken for each of us and to understand our unique roles of suffering and our unique roles of strength. That's what was both most hard and what I'm most proud of.
Mm. Excellent.
My book actually evolved out of a play that I'd written, a solo play about, I called it Palestine because I wanted to write a play I actually didn't want to write a play. I wrote in my journal, and all these people encouraged me to turn it into a play, and I did. And it was a personal story of my learning. I thought it would be interesting, having grown up basically as an American, but at the same time as the daughter of this person, that I had to figure out what the Middle East was and what it was about and what it meant to be Muslim or not Muslim or Christian or not this Shiite. And I didn't understand any of that until I was at least 28. Seriously. And it's complicated. And so what I thought I would do was tell the story. This is initially in the play, is tell the story of how I figured it out. Because I know that the subject matter of the Middle East and politics is confusing to all Americans. And we get like, oh, it's so complicated. And then there's a little bit of a fear, I think, when you discuss it, that people are like, I don't know enough about it. And people get uncomfortable asking questions because they feel like they should know more. And I just say, hey, I was born to like the most famous Arab guy in America, and I didn't know anything, and I had to figure it out on my own. So that's why I wrote the play. But there was a lot more in the play about that, and there was a lot of personal stuff. I talked about being caught in Lebanon in the war when I was 9 years old, and I talked about being in the war again in 2006 by myself. I talked about having a terribly horrific and very dangerous eating disorder and almost dying of anorexia. I talked about a lot of personal things, and I talked about in the play my father's death, but it was in 2003, exactly 10 years ago, but it was a paragraph. And every time I rehearsed the play, I would skip that paragraph, and my director would be like, stop, you have to go back. You skipped the whole part where your father dies. And I was like, oh, that's so weird. Why do I keep doing that? Mm-hmm. And then when I wrote the book, so there's part of this thing that, and as a writer, like a new writer who's never written, and I mean, I wrote a thesis in college, but it was 100 pages and I had a whole year to write. This was so difficult because I couldn't figure out what stories were important, but I knew that there was this section when I was writing, I had written, and then there'd be like, and then the part where daddy dies, and then the end. So I kept writing kind of around that part and leaving it and being like, then write about daddy's death, and then skipping it and whatever. And I just had that one paragraph from the play sort of pasted in the text, and I wouldn't go there. And the anorexia, the war, all this traumatic stuff that happened as a child was difficult to write about, but it was, I guess I've talked about it a lot in therapy, I don't know. It had healed somehow. But this death, even though I've talked about it. And so I realized a couple of things. One was writing about another reason that was very important for me to write this book was because my father, because he was Palestinian, a lot of people made a lot of assumptions about him. And I've been asked in many occasions, like, what do you say to people who say your father was anti-Semitic? And I'm like, my father was not anti-Semitic. You've obviously never read anything he ever wrote. Mm-hmm. You're just saying that because he's Arab, Palestinian, and he said he was Palestinian. So, and then when my father passed away in the New York Times, there was a long obituary that focused a lot on this one incident where we were in South Lebanon and he threw a stone at nothing. And then it was, like, printed in the New York Post that my father threw a stone at an Israeli soldier and was a terrorist, and then everyone wanted him to be fired from Columbia, which is not at all what happened. So I think, you know, the idea of having a public figure and having a name that identifies who you are and has all these assumptions that people don't really know about your family was very important for me to write about my father as my father, which is all he was to me, and to write about him as a human being. But at the same time, you want to preserve some personal memories for yourself because you don't want to share everything. And the man is gone. I'm not going to sit here and talk about how sick he was and, you know, but there were things that I thought were super important. And so when I sat down to write the part where he died, I just didn't know how to do it. So I literally wrote... my father died on Thursday, September 25th, and I started on Monday, September, I'm not good at math, 22nd, and I remembered that day, and I just wrote one sentence at a time. Then I went over to their house. He was wearing an orange shirt. He was this, and then I went through it, and it pretty much remains that way, almost unedited, because I didn't know how to do it, and it was so hard for those two reasons. One, that I really wanted to do him justice as a human being, and the other just like didn't want to go there at all. It was very
so
difficult.
Hard. Wow.
And Monica, for you, you've written fiction before, so being to make the choice to delve into this very, very personal time in your life, I'm imagining it was huge. So
it was so easy, I cannot even tell
really?
You. This was 10 million times easier than writing a novel. I'm not kidding.
Really?
Well, A, I had the characters and the story already, so that's 2 years right there.
Yeah,
it takes me 4 years to write a novel. It took 2 years to write this, so I know that it takes 2 years to do that first draft in a novel where you figure out who's who and why they're doing what their problems are. So I already knew that. But the other thing is, people ask me, they say, oh, you know, because it's about the death of a beloved father when I'm 9 years old and about my family and the town and the country, you know, all these things. But I just felt a tremendous sense of comfort being back with my childhood family when it was just an incredible feeling of comfort. And the only tear I ever shed was when they sent me the book cover. Now, I have hated every single one of my book covers, every single one. And so I had no idea what they were going to do. And I had sent them some family photographs, but I thought it was for my Amazon page or something. So there it is on the cover of the book. And I just looked, and it's a photo I'd seen a million times. This, my uncle, who's also a big character in the book, Father Bob, he was our priest uncle, very beloved uncle. And he took this was after my father died, he took us on a trip to Niagara Falls. And I could not have composed a more metaphorically apt cover for my book. This is my mother who's kind of over here alone in her grief. I don't know if you can see this back there. Here's my sister Anne, who's 22 years old, a first-year school teacher teaching at Mexico High School, and she would be my teacher when I became a high school student years later. And she's still living at home with us in our little apartment with the crabby landlords. And then here are the three little girls, and my sister Betty, who's mentally handicapped. She's 12, and she's kind of off in her own little world. And this is my sister Kathy and me, and we're 14 months apart, Catholic twins. And we're kind of joined at the hip. And here's my sister right here holding not only her three little sisters up, but the whole sky. They what they did with the photograph is they just made it go all the way up to the sky, and I just burst into tears when I saw it. And that's the only crying I did over the whole thing. The rest was unmitigated joy.
That's
yeah.
How interesting.
Something that always comes back, that the questions to people who write their memoirs is, how do you know what's true? What have you embellished, if you will? I'm reminded of a recent interview with Robert Caro, who does not write memoirs. You know, he writes these tomes about Lyndon Johnson. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that he's been able to get all of the detail that he's gotten, he said, is because he just keeps going back to the same people. He just keeps going back. He keeps going back. And on like the fifth interview, the seventh interview, somebody says, well, you know, he was standing by the window. Yeah. And then it all comes together, but he has all of the perspectives of the other folks. Yeah. So you're the center of your own story, and your memory, I must be primary, but how do you know that it's true? And then I found this quote that I want to just read to you from a guy who has written a memoir, but I thought it was interesting, and you can respond to it. This is Andre Assaman, and he's the author of a book called Harvard Square. He's comparative literature at CUNY Graduate Center. He says, writing the past is never a neutral act. Writing always asks the past to justify itself, to give its reasons, provided we could live with the reasons. What we want is a narrative, not a log, a tale, not a trial. This is why most people write memoirs using the conventions not of history, but of fiction. It's their revenge against facts that won't go away. I'd just love you to respond to that.
He was my professor in college.
Oh, well, there you go.
Wow. I actually would love to address that, because my dad wrote a memoir, and he wrote a memoir, and his four sisters were outraged. Ooh. And they were like, our parents were not like that. My father was the only son, and they had four sisters that were younger than he was. Mm-hmm. He was named after the Prince of Wales, and he was grew up in this wealthy family, and he was his mother's pride and joy. So already, his version of his parent, and his mm-hmm. father, in his memory, was very hard on him. He was 10 years older than, or 11 years older than his youngest sister. And he had a completely different experience, because he was sent to America when he was 14 or 15 by himself. Mm-hmm. So his memories were his memories, and his sisters, I remember they were upset. And I witnessed all of this, because I was about 24 when this memoir came out. A few years later, one of his sisters wrote a memoir, and it was called Teta, which means grandma in Arabic. It was called Teta, Mother, and Me, and it was about her mother, my grandmother, and their grandmother. And it was, it almost felt like you were in the same, it was like you're watching a movie, and you have my dad's story going on over here, and then you switch cameras, and you have this little girl over here, and you're seeing a completely different room. And I remember that, when I read that, thinking, this is such a, because she's a woman, she's younger than my dad, she looked a certain way, she talked a certain way, she cared about certain things. So I felt that was very interesting. And so when I wrote my book, and this also came out of the play, I realized at first, and I'm very specific, I like to be truthful, and I like to know the facts, and I, especially when you're writing about the Middle East, you don't want to mess up, because people will come at you. So I realized, I was a little kid, and I had my memories, and I didn't, so a lot of the story, and a lot of people have remarked that my mom is sort of the heroine of the book, but that's because partly I had to ask my mom about the stories. Mm-hmm. And my mom was there for me in a lot of different ways than my dad was. And she was, you know, my dad was there, and he was a great dad, but he was also in his study typing and writing and going on TV shows and traveling, and he wasn't around as much. So mm-hmm. I have a female story, and I have my mom who's still alive helping me flesh out the stories. Then you have your editor. And when I wrote the play, it was even more intense because you have to make mm-hmm. It was funny, and it was an hour and a half, so you have to make it perform well. So you have to have, like, even that part that I read about Occupy Palestine, in the real story, my brother said, you have to say Occupied Palestine, but when I did the play, I changed it to, you have to say, born is the king of Occupied Palestine. And the only reason I wrote that whole sentence out was because it sounded better in performance. Mm. So all of these things and the comedic rhythm of it. So, and then there's rules of writing and you need a story. And of course the story, a lot of people have said, oh, there's the journey ends. It's, you know, she, like I seem to come to some happy conclusion at the end, but that's because it's a book, right? So it's, there's that. And that's part. And then, so my brother has been like, well, I didn't say, there's one story that I write in the beginning that I'm explaining that illustrates my brother's personality. He's like, that's not how the conversation went. He keeps telling me, and I'm like, I know. but I'm just using this because there's more to the story is what he was saying. And I'm like, I'm using this. It's first of all my memory, not yours. And I'm using the story to illustrate a certain aspect of your personality. So I don't need the whole story. I just need this much of it. And he's like, well, you should put in the footnote that what I really said. And I'm like, no. So that's the other part of it that's also quite. And you know, but they say that when you, every time you remember something, you change it a little bit in your head. And so, and the last thing I wanted to say was I was at an event the other night, and a lot of my family friends who have known me since I was a little girl were there. And two things have come out of this. One is that I went to this school and everyone seemed to be blonde and skinny and beautiful and perfect. And I thought I was fat, hairy, ugly. You know, I had some severe, like, psychological problems about the way I looked and about being Arab and looking Arab and being hairy and dark and not skinny and not white. And every single girl who I grew up with was like, what in the hell are you talking about? Nobody thought you were ugly. Nobody thought you were fat. Nobody thought you were different. Nobody thought you were weird. And I'm like, yeah, they did. Then all my parents' friends have been like, it was very painful for us to read because we knew you as a little girl and we didn't realize any of this. Was my parents didn't. My parents thought I had like a class problem, but they didn't realize it was racist and racism, and it was deeper. And I felt horrible and dirty and other. And and they said, you know, this family friend said to me the other night, who's known me since before I was born. He said, "You were always a beautiful child. I don't know why you thought you were ugly. Like you were like I remember you." And they all say, "We remember this happy little. This is the little girl we remember." And I'm like, "Who is that?" You know, so I think that that's one of the interesting things, too, is that I was not really discriminated against, but I was picking up on things that were different about me because, as Eileen said, I was sensitive, and I was really, really sensitive, and I was in a household where lots was going on, and I was picking up other things about the world and culture and religion, and so that's the other part. It's my story. So I actually, having had the knowledge of what happened with my dad and his sisters, I went out of my way to write my own, not say too much about other people or what I thought of other, or analyze them, but just write how I saw things. But I pretty much can guarantee you that even though to me this is exactly what happened.
Somebody else doesn't think so.
People who are around me have had no idea this was how I was perceiving the situation. And I think that that's... very important. And I think that that's why, as you said, women in general should write.
And Eileen, in your book, you're clear all the way through. I made sure I asked so-and-so, could I use this?
Yes.
I went back to so-and-so to, you say that many times.
It's true that with each of my five older siblings, I vetted the chapters with them before it went to print. And only one, interestingly, had any disagreement. And I was kind of prepared for it, and I felt like I had probably projected onto her or imagined something that was really my issue, not hers. And we were able to iron it out. I was so relieved. But I have a confession to make that my mother, well, in relation to my mother, she died in 1996. And there are two stories about her that... I thought were, well, one I was wondering about a little as I wrote it, and that was the one called Music Lessons. I couldn't swear to a judge that in fact it was she who held the tape recorder and turned it off before the applause when I gave my senior recital that had meant so much, because she didn't want to swell my head. And I talked to my editor about this. I said, you know, it's all so painful to me that I can't tell you, I can't write it in blood. She said, it doesn't matter. Because it's a composite, even if it wasn't all true. It's a composite of the feeling that you, where it was conveyed to you, that you should not get credit, you should not have exceeded her in your piano skills. And so it does describe the competition. Now in the other story, it's a story about my mother was also a prankster. She was a very complex woman. She had deep depressions. She could be wildly angry. She could lecture us till we felt pulverized emotionally. And she could be the funnest person on earth to travel with. And and she loved to play pranks, and they were harmless pranks. And one of the stories that she told a number of times as I was growing up, which Paul actually videotaped when I was holding my oldest son as a baby.
Paul, your husband.
Paul, my husband, mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Was about how she and her best friend, Lila Neils, and it's called in the chapter called Made to Order, M-A-I-D, had gone to a dinner party at my grandfather's house and Grandfather Rockefeller, and he was very punctual, and when dinner was ready, he wanted everybody there, and dinner was announced, they went in, and two people were missing. And all of a sudden, and they said, well, we have to start anyway, and these two women in black uniforms with white aprons and pince-nez, as my mother called it, the little pinch glasses with no ear frame parts, came out looking rather old and jittery. And they put down the bowl of soup before my grandfather and proceeded to go like this till the pince-nez dropped in the soup. Whereupon she made a huge fuss and picked it up. Oh, I'm so sorry, ran out. And then you hear the crash of china. And my grandfather was being served beautiful china. And so he thought, oh my gosh, these people are hopeless. And at that point, they gave up their mask and came out laughing. And in my book, I say, and the maid was my mother. Well, I had remembered this for 25 years as being this way. And when I was going to be filmed on the CBS Sunday morning, the producer was saying, do you have any footage from somewhere? I finally found this. I hadn't looked at it. So I looked at it, and I heard my mother say it was her friend, Lila Neils, and some other friend, not her. And I thought, oh my God, I've just attributed all of this to her. But you know, the fact is, she would have done it. And she would have loved to have had herself as the maid in the book. Yeah. So I don't feel bad about that at all.
Monica, you said that one of the things that was you were able to write this is that you were a very observant child. Mm-hmm. So you were noticing all of these things, the sort of recorder of things that were happening in your family. Mm-hmm. And you made the point that you've only changed one thing, and I am dying to know, of course, the one thing I want to know is the one name you didn't mention. I tried to look it up, I'll confess, can't find it. But the guy that you won't name, who was the tenor from your town,
everybody asked that. His name was David Goulet.
Okay.
He's a very nice man.
See, I could have saved myself some hours.
Yeah, you could have just asked me.
But in any case, what I thought about with the same question to both Nejla and Eileen, mm-hmm. is that in your family also, you've mentioned your mentally challenged sister. Mm-hmm. So was there extra weight responsibility because, you know, we could from the outside say, well, she doesn't really giving you permission to tell the story as you would.
Oh, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. I did, all my siblings read it. My friend Denise read it. Her mother read it. Everybody who was in the book, I gave them a chance to read it. And for the older people, like Mrs. Gagnon, who was our next-door neighbor, she used to take piecework in from the shoe factories. And so we girls would go over there. She had three girls our age. And we'd go over and help her sew shoes it was my first skill. It was it was really kind of a little sweatshop, but but we really enjoyed it a lot. And she'd give us this horrible, our treat at the end was a piece of white bread, larded the hell out of it and salt it to the middle of next week. And that was called toast. And that's, yeah. So anyway, but as for Betty, what I did was I read to her all of the parts that she was in. And I mean, Betty's a delightful human being and just is very proud of me. Every time we're anywhere, she goes, this is my sister Moni, what's a writer? You know, she's very proud of me. And so I said, well, Bet, this is the part you're in, so I'm reading. And I've written essays about her as well.
I know. I read one that you wrote for Huffington Post. What I have mm-hmm. to say, and you will appreciate this when you read the book, because I know you all will, is that you presented her in such a way that was not at all sentimentalized and not at all maudlin. And I just, and when she speaks, it's in capital letters. So I just felt I knew her.
Yeah,
I really thought I knew her.
Well, you would love her.
Yeah.
All right. I am leaving a block of time, as I've said, for all of you to ask your questions, because I feel you. I get mad when I don't get a chance to ask questions. So if you have a question, raise your hand, and we're going to get the mic to you so that we can get it all recorded. And I can't see very well, so anybody have a hand up? In the
way
back? Okay.
Back there.
There you go.
Hello, I'd like to make a comment on what you talked about what's true and what's not true. I'm going to tell a little story, very short.
Very, we need a question.
Very short. I'm a teenager. My father had already died, and I'm talking to his two sisters. And I want information. Somehow I knew I was going to be a family therapist someday. So I'm asking questions. I say, where did you come from? I know it's Russia or Poland, but where did you come from? And Aunt Ida says to me, we came from, and she was born there, and she gives me a name. Aunt Yetta walks over and says, don't tell her that. That's not a good town to come from. And she gives me another name. So even if I had believed in the truth, I know there is not real truth out there. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Question? Here's a hand up here.
Is this working? Closer to your
Hold
mouth.
Closer.
Now that I know this is being recorded, I would be more circumspect than before. But I'm writing a memoir, and I'm kind of stuck. There are your secrets, and then there are other people's secrets, mm-hmm. particularly in your family. And we have, you know, there's a gay person who killed himself that nobody knew about. No one knew he was gay. There was another person who committed adultery with his best friend, and then we have a member of our family who nobody knows about except for me. And a very serious illness, which are other people's stories, but they are my story too. And I'm wondering, have you hit upon any really difficult periods with other people's stories that you somehow feel you need to conceal, or, you know, where do you draw the line?
I can talk about that. Since this was my first experience writing a book, and I was very nervous about that exact thing. What I would say is, as the other two panelists have said, I showed everyone the draft who was in it. Even this girl I went to school with, who I haven't spoken to in 30 years. Thank God for Facebook. I'm like, here's what I wrote about you. Is this okay? And then of course, there's your editor, and then there's the your book will get legally vetted before it's published. No, I know. But what I'm saying is, with your editor, she would say, just write. And then, because what you have to do when you're writing is just write it all. And then when you're starting to craft the story and the narrative starts to take shape and form more and more, you start to be able to see. And there are things, both of my play and the book, that I insisted were important. And then I realized, oh, I guess I don't really need that. So that's what's the great thing about an editor is you can just say, I'm nervous about revealing this particular thing, and they will, A, help you find another way to do it that's not as, you know, that's somehow, or say, maybe this, find a way to show you that maybe it's not the most necessary thing to reveal all the information that you'd like. And what I found was interesting was that when I first wrote, like, my first few drafts, I was writing all this stuff, and I was like, I don't want the whole world to know all this stuff about me. Mm. And then my editor would give it back to me, and she would have pages cut out, and I was like, how rude. This is what happened. And she'd be like, "Not, we don't need 8 stories that prove that you were, you know, thought you were fat. We only need 1. And so then I had this attitude of, like, someone else is reading this from the outside, so that she's seeing what is helping the story along and what is necessary, and she's guiding me. And every time she cuts something, it means that's one more thing that's personal that I don't have to reveal to my audience. So for me, that was helpful. And then when it was legally vetted, the lawyer was just, he just explains, like, for me, it was like I wrote how my parents got married, and I say they woke up and my dad was like, let's go to City Hall. But I said something like, my mom was living with him at that point, I suppose. And he's like, does your mom know that you wrote that? Do you know that your parents were living together? And I was like, no, I just assume. And he's like, you better check with your mom because she could sue you. And I was like, oh, I mean, it was things like that. So you're not even going to know. It's probably going to be something you're totally not aware of. But in terms of the emotional thing, I think it's important to write it out and get it out and see why you're sort of, it's more of like the therapeutic process of seeing how this person or this event or this situation fuels your view of your story and how it feeds into it and affects it, and then like put it aside and then come back to it and see what you want to do with it, because mm-hmm. you may find it's not necessary or it can be concealed in a different way or something like that. I don't know.
Good answer. Is somebody right okay. over here?
Oh, I got one last question. I've just been told. Sorry.
Miss Saeed, who are you now?
That's a great question. I have no idea. I'm still, when I was a little girl, I would say, this is interesting, when people ask what my dad did, because everyone else's dad was a lawyer or a banker or something. My dad was a professor, but he was also a doctor, but he was also a teacher, but he was also a father, but he was also a Palestinian. And so I was like, he's so many things. It's amazing, my dad. He's so many things. And I think that when people ask me what my identity is, it kind of just depends on, I mean, in terms of where I'm from, I often say the place I identify with most is New York. I'm a New Yorker, but I'm a woman. Depends what we're talking about. I don't know who I am. I know I'm deeply rooted in being Lebanese, which is difficult. I mean, my mother's family is from Lebanon, but my father's family is Palestinian, and most of my Palestinian family is in Lebanon. And so, but people who want my father to be Palestinian get really uncomfortable, and I say I'm Lebanese, but I'm still also Palestinian, but mainly I'm American. I'm an Upper West Sider. I always say I'm a Jew. I mean, look at the way I talk. I'm always worried about... So I think all of these things make up part of who you are. Like, it's not... I don't know. I don't really have an identity, but I have many at the same time.
Yeah. That was a great last question. If I could appropriate Eileen's title, I'd say you're all becoming.
Yeah.
You're becoming yourself.
Yes.
Thank you so much for sharing your stories with us.
Thank you very much. Yeah. It was beautifully organized.